Hello. Welcome, everybody. We're going to get started. We'll try to begin this weekend event with starting roughly on time, and maybe that will carry over to the rest of the weekend. We'll see. Welcome to LaBrie Fellowship. This is both one of our regular Friday night lectures, but it's also the first event in our winter seminar, which continues through all day tomorrow. And I just put that up on the screen, but just to give you a sense of events that are happening tomorrow. The name of this seminar is "What Does God or Who Does God Say We Are? Contemporary Importance of the Image of God." And so tonight, as well as throughout the day tomorrow, we'll be exploring that as a really central Christian belief that has implications in every direction as we look at the world around us. So the question of who does God say we are, it's really a question of what is a human being. Tonight I'm kind of doing two introductions. I'm doing the introduction for the whole theme weekend, and then I'm going to do the introduction to my talk. And hopefully you'll be awake by the end of those. So the question of what is a human being, how do we think of ourselves, is not a simple question. It's an incredibly complex question and a controversial question today. There are many, many competing anthropologies. So, and an anthropology is what you think a human being is, your view of human beings. And there are many competing views, many different ways to explain what a human being is. Every individual on some level wants to have a strong sense of their own identity. But is there a shared identity that all human beings have? Is there something basic and universal to all people? This question has huge implications and potentially dire implications depending on how you answer that question. What your anthropology is really, really matters. It determines how you answer all kinds of ethical questions. What should be done with people? What can you get away with doing to people and not? How should people be educated? How do we cope with inequalities between people? What constitutes progress in society? What does justice even mean? Your answer to all those different questions will vary tremendously depending on what you think a human being is. And who gets to decide what a human being is? Am I? This sounds like a silly question, but it's becoming less and less of a silly question. Am I qualitatively a different sort of thing than my dog or my computer? Many people would argue that human beings are just the most developed of animals, and so there's nothing qualitatively different between me and my dog. It's quantitative. I'm just more developed than my dog, more evolved or whatever. Many people would describe the brain as basically just a complex biological computer, and the boundaries between the brain and computer functions are getting more and more blurred. And so these are highly relevant questions for today. The Bible teaches that the church has actually always affirmed this, that people are made in the image of God, and that this is the most fundamental fact about people. It's what makes a human a human. And so this is a particular anthropology, a particular way of viewing a person, and just like every other anthropology, it has all kinds of ethical implications. So this is kind of part of the motivation of wanting to do a whole seminar on the image of God, because there's so many different directions it can go in, so many different topics which touch on and are really about the image of God. So tomorrow morning, you can see the little schedule here, Dick will be lecturing on what if we do away with the image of God. And so that's basically a look at some of the alternative anthropologies to the image of God. We look around us, and the society around us has already basically given up on this idea of humans being made in God's image. What are those alternatives, and what are the implications of those? alternatives. What do you have when you give up the image of God? And so that'll be Dick's lecture tomorrow morning. And then in the afternoon, you'll see there's two different events in the afternoon. After lunch, we're calling that whole section of the day Image of God Expressed. And Danny Lawson, who is a helper with us right now, is going to be performing some piano music and talking about it, the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. And then a good friend of mine named Adam Combs, who... Did he just walk in? There he is over there. We'll be doing a presentation on a nonprofit which he runs called Waypoint Adventure, which serves people with disabilities, enabling them to get outside and participate in outdoor programs that they otherwise would not be able to participate in. And both of these, I think, will be highlighting in a very specific way what it is to express the image of God. And so at Le Brie, we tend to do a lot of talking, a lot of lecturing, a lot of lecturing, a lot of lecturing. And this time we decided to mix it up with more of a variety of media. And I think it'll be really engaging. So that's kind of my overview introduction. Tonight we're dealing with really what the question of what is the image of God? What does the Bible say about it? How are we supposed to think about it if we're Christians? And I think we live in a culture, at least in the West, where people are expected to be really nice to each other. Maybe not every circle you run into, but there's an expectation that we're supposed to be basically nice and decent, kind to one another. But there's not a very robust belief that provides grounding for this. Another way of phrasing it is, what is it about a human being that warrants good treatment? And the average person you meet on the street wouldn't be able to tell you, really, probably. They would know that you're supposed to treat people well. You're not supposed to exploit and hurt and cheat and lie to people. But what is it about a human being that warrants good treatment? Even among Christians, the Imago Dei, the image of God, that's Latin for the image of God. The Imago Dei is mentioned a lot as a reason why we should treat people well. But often there's not a developed enough understanding of what the image of God means to really stand up to challenges. So do I have a robust enough theology of the image of God to treat a person with respect who is hurling insults at me? I have to have a pretty strong, not just a developed theology, but a deep conviction of the image of God for me to not return insults at this person. Do I have a robust enough theology of the image of God to impact my view of all kinds of different things? Immigration, the refugee crisis, abortion, the merging of the human brain with computer technology, all kinds of different issues in which the image of God really is should be central to our thinking. But do we have a developed enough idea of that to really to stand up to the real challenges? And I think many of us don't as Christians, and so we're just sort of swept along with what the culture around us says about human beings. I'm going to start really by talking about the image of God in two ways. I'm getting over a cold, so I'm going to be drinking a lot tonight.
Water.
Drinking a lot of water, thank you. There's tea also over here. But this is my friend Andrew, is making sure I don't start any scandalous rumors. Okay. So the image of God in two ways to think about it, and I'll get to this in just a minute, but I think it's something that demands explanation and clarification. It sounds simple, and we use it all the time, but it's not. My hope is that as we clarify what is actually meant by the image of God, we'll be both encouraged and convicted. I found myself studying for this talk to be deeply encouraged, because it was really a reminder of me that God's evaluation in his eyes to be a human being is a high and honorable thing. Our sin and our brokenness are not intrinsic to what it is to be a human. we are all sinful and broken. But these are degradations of our humanity. And one day we'll finally be, in the fullest sense, human again. In the way that God intended. So it's good to be a human being. That's the encouraging thing about the image of God. It's also convicting because the image of God is in desperate need of restoration, I think, in ourselves and in the world around us. So part of the Christian calling until Christ returns is to be restorers of the image. And this is also a high calling, but a very challenging one. So the two different ways I want to start off by thinking about the image of God is really in terms of human capacities, the image as seen in human capacities, and then the image of God as a fundamental identity, as our fundamental identity. And I want to make this clear from the outset that both of these ways of viewing the image of God, I think, have merit, but the second one is the foundational one. The first one, the thinking about it in terms of our capacities, is good and right as long as it's glued to the second. And I'll explain more what I mean there. The reason I want to start with human capacities is that I think it's the way most of us, it's what comes to most of our minds when we hear the image of God. We think of all the things that humans can do. We often think of the image as being connected to the abilities and gifts that humans have and animals don't. What distinguishes us from the animals? And we sometimes think of these unique human abilities as evidence that the image of God is a real thing. So there are many, many things we could point to, and Christians throughout history have pointed to different human capacities as the essential thing about the image of God. And I'll just mention a few. We see evidence for the image of God when we see our capacity for rational thought. Say, that's a big one. A lot of people point to that as something that's central to being in God's image. Our ability to perceive and appreciate beauty, which is very connected to our imaginations and our creativity. Our ability to envision different realities, to use our imaginations in that way. The fact that we're capable of relationships. Our ability to use symbolic language, in other words, use words that correspond to concepts, without which relationships would not be possible. Our ability to intentionally make choices that impact the world around us, and this is a kind of mastery that the Bible calls dominion. That's something that very often is pointed to as something that's central to the image of God. The fact that we're conscious of ourselves as distinct beings. So self-awareness, something the animals don't quite seem to have in the same way we do. The fact that we're capable of empathy and kindness and heroism. The fact that we can't help but create culture wherever we go. The fact that we have desires and longings. The fact that we tell jokes and find them funny. The fact that we can't stop longing for transcendence in some way. That we need to find meaning. We want to have meaning. We want to be significant in some way that's beyond just what we can see. This is just a random list. We go on and on and on and on. Things that we associate with the image of God. Capacities that humans uniquely have and that make us like God in some way. Just some observations about these capacities. Each of these is an example of how we resemble the Creator more than the animals. I already said that. It ends up being a way in which we're distinguishing between ourselves and the other creatures we see. This paradigm of capacities, I think, is evidence-based. We look around, we observe what humans are up to all over the world or throughout history, and we conclude that we're seeing signs of the image of God. We view them as evidence of a theological reality. Who but image bearers would have built the pyramids or composed sonatas or invented cars or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. You may have noticed that sometimes the word image is used as a verb. When we use the word image as a verb, we're usually thinking of it in terms of these observable qualities, these capacities. So we image our Creator when we make art We image our Creator when we offer hospitality to a stranger, or when we use words at all to communicate. We're imaging our Creator, or when we puzzle through a math problem. Say if you're taking an exam in school and you have a word problem that you puzzle through, because you're capable of this kind of rational thought, you're imaging your Creator. I never felt like I was imaging my Creator when I took math tests, but there's something of significance going on there. The image is something we see by observing what people actively do. That's this first category here, and I don't actually want to dismiss it. This way of thinking entirely. I think striving to image as a verb, to image God, is one of the things we're called to do in all kinds of different ways. And these capacities that I just listed a few minutes ago are a part of what makes human beings the glorious things that they are. But the capacities model here is only one way of thinking about the image of God. And if it's the only way we think about the image of God, then we really run into trouble. We hit a wall very quickly. Because we all know that people differ drastically in their gifts and in their abilities. So some of the ways in which people differ are in the very capacities that we associate with the Imago Dei. So if you take creativity, if creativity is a criteria for the image of God, what about the less creative people? Or if dominion is a criteria for the image of God, what about the person who is suffering with a debilitating illness and is in a hospital bed most of their life, unable to even move? Are they somehow less in the image of God because of that limit on their dominion? Is your neighbor closer to the true image of God because they're better with words than you are? Do you have to come up with some equal equivalent gift in order to be as much of an image bearer as them? Or is a baby the image of God? A baby who really displays nothing except needs. So if the image of God is grounded in our capacities alone, then it's clearly something that people have in varying degrees. The image of God becomes a decisive way of excluding people or creating hierarchies between people. And I just want to make it clear, I don't think this is the image of God. This is not my view of what the image of God is. Interestingly, the Bible never provides us with a list of capacities that qualify people for being image bearers. The Bible never says, okay, here's what makes an image bearer, and then lists all these things that human beings can do. The Bible never does that. So, it's something that we really need to believe in independently of the capacities we see or don't see in each other. Human abilities can be a pointer to the image of God, I think. But the image itself is something to affirm even when there are no discernible pointers, or when there's even evidence to the contrary. The image of God is something to affirm even when there's evidence to the contrary. And to be clear, this is something I really do believe. It's only because we have the image of God that people can love and create and solve problems and build culture and do all those things. But it's not the same thing to say that the image of God consists of these abilities. It's not the same thing to say that the image of God consists of all those capabilities. Those things are signs that point to something deeper, that's more foundational, and they're not qualifications or criteria. So here we come to a very different way of thinking about the image of God, not as the sum of our capacities, but as our fundamental identity. There's a wonderful book that has been very helpful to me by Anthony Heikema called Created in God's Image. There it is. And I'll be quoting him and sort of using some of his thinking throughout here. But he makes the point that in Genesis 1, the image of God is what we are. It's not something we have. It's what we are. We are the image. It's not a characteristic. Another way of saying this is that it's our true identity in a way that all the things we do in life are not. And to use philosophical jargon, it's an ontological claim, basically. It's a claim about the being or essence of a human being. And I just want to make a few crucial observations about this. First of all, we are now using the word image exclusively as a noun, not a verb. Before, we talked about imaging God by doing all kinds of different things. Now we're talking about being God's image as a noun, which is something that is the case about me, whether or not I am striving to image God as a verb. Secondly, it's the source of intrinsic value. And I'll try to explain what I mean by that. Intrinsic value. A human being has worth and dignity embedded in them, not based on what they can do, but because of what they are, by virtue of being a human. So you never saw a person who wasn't an image of God. Thirdly, humans have a value that's given. It comes from outside ourselves. It's the Lord himself that bestows the image of God on people and the value and the dignity that come with it. So we are in his image because he said so. And there's really no better possible reason to affirm the image of God than God said so. I found it fascinating just looking at what we'll look at it in some detail in a minute, but the creation story in Genesis 1 where God makes Adam and Eve. God does not respond to what he sees in Adam and Eve by granting them his image. So he's not giving them a designation sort of after he's made them. Wow, you're like me, you know. It's something he decides that they are to be before they exist. He decides that they're going to bear his image before he's even made them. And if you think about it, it's hard to impress someone before you exist. The image is clearly a gracious gift of God, and he honors humans because he wants to, no other reason. So I was just thinking, very often on Monday mornings we have we sing the hymn, Be Thou My Vision. We have a time of hymn singing and prayer in here. And one of the lines that struck out to me in the past week was, I think it's in the third verse, Be thou my dignity, thou my delight. And there's a way in which that is sort of echoing Genesis 1, that God is our dignity. It's not so much that God observes us and sees that we're dignified and then says, oh, you must have dignity. God himself is the one that bestows dignity on us, and he decided to do it before people even existed. Fourthly, I'm on number four. The Imago Dei is not bestowed on different people in varying degrees. It's all or nothing. You either have it or you don't. And if you're human, you do. Because of this, the Imago Dei is a great equalizer of human beings. It elevates the weak and seemingly insignificant people to a place of great significance. And it forbids the rich and powerful to place themselves above the weak. Which might feel to the rich and powerful like a demotion, but it's not. Number five is the only thing about us that, and this is an expression that a scholar named Mary Stuart Van Leeuwen has sort of coined. I'm not sure where she says this. It might just have been in conversation with somebody, but she said this: it's the only thing about a human being that goes all the way down. Which is kind of an interesting way of talking about the image of God. It's the only thing about you that goes all the way down. It's not an aspect of your identity, like, say, your sexuality. It is your identity. And this means that every human being, no matter how much they may differ from you, whether it's ethnically or racially or economically, in terms of moral behavior, when in history they lived, political views, all those differences, every human being shares something with you that far outweighs all of those differences. Because the image of God goes all the way down in each person in a way that race, gender, your country of origin do not go all the way down. Even though those things are very significant aspects of who we are as human beings, they don't go all the way down. And so given all this, I think we can see that our capacities are not the image of God, but they are expressions of the image. Ways in which our true identity can show forth, or ways in which they don't show forth, because we are living in a world that's been affected by the fall, and we'll come to that a little bit later as we talk about the biblical texts. But our capacities are affected in all kinds of ways by the fact that the world has fallen and that we're participating in that. I'm going to move now to looking at the Bible in more detail. I wanted to just lay that out ahead of time as a sort of a structured way of thinking about the image of God, which is taken from the Bible. It's not as if this is I'm not imposing these ideas on the Bible, but now I want to look more specifically at Scripture. And I found it to be very fruitful, actually, to meditate as much as possible on the whole biblical narrative. From beginning to end, in terms of the image of God. This is something that's really interesting to do about all kinds of things. Like earlier this term, I lectured on the fear of God, and I found myself looking at all of Scripture kind of with that as my lens and seeing it in all kinds of places. And I've been trying to do that with the image of God as my lens. And the Bible really shows us that the human story, our story, is the story about the image of God. Where did it come from? What has become of it? Can it be restored? How? Is there anything we can do? There's a wonderful chapter in a new book by Tim Keller. It's called Loving the City, and there's a chapter that Andy Crouch wrote. It's sort of a response to the book. And he really talks about the image of God as a model for cultural engagement, how we think about engaging with culture. And he breaks it up into a similar way that I just talked about. He says the Bible is about the image of God that's given, so that's the creation, the image of God that's broken, that's the fall, the image of God that's revealed in Jesus Christ, and then the image of God that's restored, which is the story of sanctification and one day fulfillment, new creation. And so I found, as I read that chapter, I was sort of thinking Andy Crouch's thoughts after him in a less erudite way. Anyway, check out the chapter. In the Old Testament, the specific phrase, image of God, it's Tselem Elohim, occurs only three times, and all three times are in Genesis. And there's a lot of scholarly debate over why that is. Why isn't the term image of God used throughout the Old Testament, given how important it is? And I'm not going to get into that debate really at all. But suffice it to say that the image of God is implied and assumed on every page of the Old Testament and New Testament. Every command having to do with ethics between people, including the Ten Commandments. And every judgment for mistreatment of people, you read the book of Leviticus or any of the prophets, all of it is grounded in Genesis 1:26-28, which is God creating people in his image. So let's look at the biblical story now, and starting with creation, and just give me 1 second. So on the sixth day, God creates people, and that is after he has created what I call habitable space. He's been creating spaces and making separations between things. He's separated light and dark. He's separated water from sky. He calls forth land out of the sea. He's making distinctions and creating order where there was chaos, which is another way of saying he's making habitable space for creatures to live in, for plants to grow in, and ultimately for human beings. go back to that in a minute. I'll just read. This is Genesis 1, 26 to 28. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." And if you read the beginning of Genesis leading up to this, it's clear, I think, because of just the amazing rhythm that's established and the way in which everything is building, that this is the pinnacle of God's creation. This is the highlight, you could say. Everything is leading up to this point. Even before the image is mentioned, it's clear that God is up to something new. And this is something that Anthony Heikema, various observations that he made that are very helpful. When God is about to create people, it's the only act of creation in which he announces his intention beforehand. It's like he's sort of rubbing his hands in delight and saying, "Now for the main event." God does not feel the need to announce his intentions before making anything else. Only when he makes people. And that's striking. In addition, the language of creating, I think, is subtly different when it comes to people. Up until day six, God has been saying things like, "Let there be light. Let the dry ground appear. Let the land bring forth plants and creatures. Let the oceans teem with fish." God is calling forth whole environments and calling forth creatures and plants. But something about the language implies a distance between himself and the thing he's making. He's sort of standing back, as it were, and calling things into existence. But when it comes to human beings, he does not say, "Let there be people." He doesn't call us into existence, neither does he tell the land to just produce us. He says, "Let us make." And if you read this alongside the sort of parallel account of God's creation of people in Genesis 2, starting in verse 7, I think the contrast is even more striking, because that's where it talks about God forming Adam out of the dust, which is something he does not do with anything else, and breathing life into him. So this is the language of very close proximity. It's personal touch. God is right there in the dirt, forming Adam with his hand, so to speak. I'm not sure what that means for God, but that's certainly the metaphorical language that we're given. So he's personally involved in a totally different way when he makes people. He's not calling them forth. And then in Genesis 1, 26, God says, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness." All of the other creatures and plants are made according to their kind, but humans are the only creature that's made in his image. So there are two Hebrew words here. We saw them a second ago. Tselem, which is translated image, and demuth. I'm not sure how to pronounce these words. If there's anybody who knows Hebrew better than I do, that's... Thanks. Which is usually translated likeness. And they're often used synonymously, but they are subtly different. Tselem is derived from the Hebrew root, which means to carve or cut. So it implies a carved representation of something else, whether it's something made out of wood or metal or stone, a statue of a person or an animal or something is tselem. It's sometimes translated as idol, like the physical representation of a god. Demuth literally means to be like. So when the two words are put together, the image and to be like, it basically means human beings are a representation of God that are like him in some particular way. One commentator said that the image expresses but does not depict God. It's an adequate representation, not a facsimile. So there's a difference between us and God, obviously. There's never any implication in Genesis that there's a confusion between the creator and the creature. That's a distinction that is absolutely in place and remains in place. But it's an amazing thing that human beings at the beginning of creation are an adequate representation of God, somehow. The Old Testament scholar J. Richard Middleton has pointed out that throughout much of Christian history, theologians have stressed just the metaphysical similarities between people and God. In other words, we're like God because we have a soul. He is spirit, and we're connected to him somehow in that metaphysical way. And he points out that this neglects the obvious importance of the physical body, the human body. The word salem, which is translated idol very often, means a physical representation of a God. So while having a body is something that distinguishes us from the infinite creator, he doesn't have a finite body like we do. It's something that makes us different from him, yet at the same time it's central to being in his image, because I can't image anything without a body. It's a physical term. So one of the central ways, I think, in which, you know, when we think about the word demuth, to be like, and that's what's caused so much speculation over the years about all these capacities. Well, what is it exactly that makes us like God? Well, he's this and he's that, and so are we. But I think one of the foundational things, even more than what I mentioned earlier, is that the fact that we are persons at all. Because God is not, as the Bible reveals who God is, it does not tell us a story about an abstract force or some vague sum total of all things. It's not a pantheistic picture of deity. God is personal. He is a person. He has a will. There are things he loves. He speaks. He communicates. And our personhood is derived from God's personhood. The only reason why we are people who can make choices, who can say things, who can have relationships, is because the one who made us in his image is a person. And so we're made to be capable of relationship, really in order to be in relationship with him and with each other. So being in God's image really is to be in relationship with him. That is what its intention is in the beginning. But then the text continues. Immediately it says, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. God does not just announce his intention to create beings who represent him and are like him. He seamlessly announces his purpose for doing so, so that they may rule over the rest of creation. And when we asked the question earlier, how exactly are we like God, and we thought about all the amazing capabilities humans have, we were missing a crucial point, because according to Genesis 1:26, we're made in God's image in order to be given responsibilities. That's a different sort of thing. We're in his image in order to be given responsibilities. And it's particularly in our responsibility of ruling that we resemble the God who made us. Who here likes responsibility? That's true, actually. That's good. I'm glad for that. For many of us, responsibility is an ugly word. It implies accountability. it implies the possibility of failure and shame. We sometimes avoid them. And so a lot of times as we talk about the creational purpose for human beings, we have to redeem certain words in our minds, because we only think of them in a negative light. This is a picture of responsibilities being given to people as part of their imaging of God. So, again, J. Richard Middleton, who I mentioned earlier, he talks about the royal imagery of Genesis 1. Just as God is shown to be the supreme ruler, the king over his cosmos, the people made in his image are sub-rulers in the world. They're finite, they're completely dependent on him. There's never a sense in which they're autonomous in creation at all. But they still have a real authority. They're told to rule. And Middleton writes this. He says, humans have a royal function or office as God's representatives and agents in the world, given authorized power to share in God's rule over the earth's resources and creatures. And this royal imagery is what is often called stewardship, God entrusting people to care, or entrusting his world to people to care for. And the extent to which we are like God in other ways, our dominion, our creativity, our relational nature, it's not really discussed here directly. The emphasis is on what we're called to do. But that being said, these capacities are clearly necessary if we're going to respond to God's call, right? If we're going to rule over the world that he has made, we'll have to be capable of doing that. And if you're like me, the notion of human rule over creation as being a good thing is sort of hard to fathom. Because this is one of those words that if we're going to get Genesis 1, we have to sort of redeem it in our minds or think imaginatively about it in a way that gets us away from our own post-fall, sometimes cynical way of understanding words. So rule and dominion are some of those words that need redemption in our minds, I think, because it's very, very hard, particularly given the environmental crisis and all of the problems of human exploitation of the natural world. It's very, very hard to hear the word dominion without thinking domination, or to hear this description of human purpose to rule as being somehow a green light to exploit. And sadly, there's lots of evidence that we can see around us, sometimes perpetrated by Christians that would reinforce this. But I think we have to remember, if we're trying to understand this text as it stands by itself, we have to remember who it is that we're imaging. The human beings in this context are completely under God's authority still. And the kind of rule that he is encouraging is one of care and cultivation and exploration, much in the same way that he is responsible for caring for and sustaining his own world and holding it together in every moment. It is rule, but it's a rule that is not exploitation. It's a rule that has in mind the good of the thing it's ruling. And as we image God, that's the sort of rule that was intended for us in creation. We tend to creation, we subdue creation for our sake, yes, but also for creation's sake, which actually implies that today it's very hard to think of it in a way that isn't a zero-sum game. Somehow, if something that benefits humans must destroy the environment in some way, right? You know, it's either jobs for people in the logging industry or it's trees. You know, which are you going to pick? And very often that's what we're given, a zero-sum sort of game. In this case, the well-being of human beings and the well-being of creation are one and the same. And in a creation that's already good, there's room for development. So there's not a static picture of perfection in creation. It's a picture of goodness, but room for development, room for further ordering that human beings are capable of and expected to exercise. So this idea of rule, human rule, is not humans as a blot on the landscape or a cancer ecologically. It's a very different picture of what human interaction with the world is like. So, the purpose for the image of God is reiterated after God makes people in what's become known as the cultural mandate. And so you can see the last section here. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." And I I feel strongly that this should have been called the cultural blessing, not the cultural mandate. First of all, the text calls it a blessing. God blessed them and said to them, the blessing is not separated from the him saying to them this. This is contained in the blessing. So God blessed them by saying, be fruitful and multiply is the implication, I think, in the language there. It also parallels the way in which God blessed everything else in his creation. God blessed the animals and told them to be fruitful and multiply. God blessed the fish and the birds. And so this is really a blessing first and foremost. And in a sense, the reason why I think it should be called the cultural blessing, the word mandate implies that they're being given some arduous task that they might not want to do if it wasn't for the fact God was making them do it. When you have to mandate something, it's usually implies that it's something that someone wouldn't do unless you mandated it. In reality, it's the very thing that God just made them to do. And it's the very thing that will actually give them most joy. Essentially, God is saying, go explore the world, understand it, order it, care for it, grow good food and eat it, make love and have children, name things, learn how to build houses. And in a pre-fallen world, this would not have had to be a command, right? It's a little bit like, I've tried to think of an analogy for this, but it's a little bit like Danny, who's going to be playing music for us tomorrow. So imagine I discovered a stack of previously undiscovered Beethoven piano pieces. I'm for sure this is never going to happen. And I come to Danny, who's an amazing piano player, and I say, you have to look at these. You must play them. It's not really something I have to mandate for Danny. It's an amazing gift, and that's the first thing he would want to do, right? So that's sort of how I read this. Andy Crouch, in the chapter I referred to earlier in Tim Keller's book, he points out that the cultural mandate is simply an expression of the image of God. It's the way that God tells human beings to live into their image-bearing nature. To go and make culture is the very thing that the image of God is for. And in fact, because human beings are so vulnerable, Andy Crouch makes this point, and so weak compared to most animals, they can only survive in culturally rich environments. He says, human beings are the only animals that need clothes to survive and need to be cared for years and years and years. Most animals are born and they can kind of get along pretty quickly. Human beings are the only creatures that need clothes to survive, and think about the culturally rich context that's necessary for even production of clothing. People need culture to survive. It's not an optional extra. So to summarize what we've talked about so far, the image of God is an amazing status given to people, but it's a status that was given in order that we might share in the responsibility of God's rule, which in our own limited way means making culture. And if this is familiar information to you, which it is for a lot of us, when we talk about the image of God, it's something we've heard over and over again, it's very easy to miss how radical this would have been to people in the ancient Near East. And we'll talk about this more a little bit later. This really... it's one of the many places in the Bible where when you read it, you're like, this is really revelation from God here, because this is not something that someone would have made up who was living in the ancient Near East. In the ancient Near East, only kings and pharaohs had divine status, and actually only kings and pharaohs were described as images of God. Very often, the king or the ruler of a nation was sort of a go-between between the gods of that nation and the people, and had sort of semi-divine status and was called an image of God to be obeyed in the way that the god would be obeyed. Only political rulers were seen as representing the gods to other people. But in Genesis 1, it says, no, all people are images of God. Male and female, that's radical in the ancient Near East, are both equally in the image of God. No distinctions made at all. All human beings have this calling in the beginning to rule, not just a king. And I want to go on what I hope is a fruitful tangent right now, because something that's been really fascinating to me and helpful in thinking about the image of God. Many scholars have pointed out the connection between God's creation of the cosmos and the building of an ancient temple. And any questions about this can be referred to Joshua Chestnut over here. He's read more about it than I have and gave me some of these resources tonight, so I appreciate that. Gregory Beale and John Walton are two scholars that have done a lot of work on this. It happens in several ways. The tabernacle and later the temple in Jerusalem were built to be symbolic models of the cosmos. There's all kinds of creation imagery built into the temple. There's a sea, which is this massive big bronze bowl holding water. There's the lights, which represent the sun and the moon and other sort of cosmic lights. All kinds of plant life depicted on the walls. It goes on and on and on. But also, the language of Genesis 1 strongly suggests that all creation, the whole cosmos, is being spoken about as a temple. So it goes both ways. That the temple is like a microcosm of creation, and creation is one massive temple. And the language in Genesis 1, a lot of it is temple language, or language that's only used when referring to temples, which is a theologically rich concept here, because it means that the whole cosmos is God's place. He's not located in one spot. He's not a local god alongside other local gods. Everything is under him. Everything is his. The world is his place. One of the definitions of a temple is a meeting place between heaven and earth. And Genesis 1 suggests that the meeting place between heaven and earth is the whole earth, because God is everywhere and it's all his. And so you can see echoes of this in Isaiah 6, as well as in some of the Psalms, when it says the whole earth is full of God's glory. Now that is temple language. When you hear about the glory filling the temple, when God comes down and fills the tabernacle, fills the temple, it's the presence of the glory of God in this place. But then every once in a while, the Bible tells us actually the whole world is full of his glory. So he's present to people in a special way in the temple. And yet, don't think for a second that he's contained by that, or that that's the only place he is. But his glory fills the whole earth, because the whole earth is his temple. So, in the ancient Near East, whenever a temple was built, the culminating event was when the image of the deity would be placed in the inner sanctuary of that building. So usually it would be a statue representing that deity. And it was a solemn occasion. It's at this point that the building could actually function as a temple, once that image had been placed in the temple. It's referred to as an inauguration, a sort of inaugural event. The temple can now be a temple. But if you were to walk into the Holy of Holies in the temple in Jerusalem, which you could not have done, but you would not have found an image of Yahweh. And in fact, the Lord strictly forbade the Israelites to even attempt to make a statue of him. There's two warnings that God gives in the Old Testament. One is against worshiping idols, worshiping things that aren't God. And then the other one is making a graven image, which is making some sort of representation of the true God, which you can't do. And that's what Aaron does when he makes the golden calf. That's a graven image. He's saying, this is the God that brought you out of Egypt. So he's trying to connect the people's concept of Yahweh to this golden calf. Both are completely unacceptable to God. Why? Well, because obviously the whole world is God's temple, and yes, he is too transcendent and too big to be depicted in wood and stone. That's one reason. But the other reason is this: the image of God was already placed in the temple of creation in Genesis 1. And so the absence of a Yahweh statue in the temple sent a very, very clear and a lot of scholars say defiant message to other cultures and their definition of what a human being is. It sends the message, you can't physically depict or represent Yahweh, the invisible living God, because Yahweh has already given you his likeness, and that's your neighbor. Your neighbor is the image of God. And if you want to honor, God is saying, if you want to honor me properly, you'll honor your neighbor. Just as right worship of God would involve showing, or just, you know, if you think of another ancient temple, the right worship of a deity would involve showing respect or honor to the image in the temple, which represents that deity. So right worship of Yahweh is always inseparable from loving your neighbor, who is God's image. And then, of course, the fall happens, which I think the longer we read the Bible and the more we dig into it, the more affected by the tragedy of this we are, I think. The breadth of the destruction and the unraveling of God's good creation. Adam and Eve reject God's rule by radically overreaching the legitimate authority he gave them. Eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil was not about satisfying their hunger. They could have eaten from many, many other trees. But they were grasping at an authority to be determiners of good and evil. And it's important to say that the health of the image of God, if that's to be a healthy thing, in a sense, the accuracy of the likeness between us and God depends on people's obedience to the one who made them. So God, because he is the master designer of humanity, is the one who gets to set the parameters for how humans should live. And he's the maker and the lawgiver. He's both at once. And the beautiful thing about this is that the way that he calls us to live is the way that we will flourish. Because he's the one who made us. He knows why we were made. He knows our purpose. He knows what behavior will lead to life and what will lead to death. So what does this mean for the image of God after the fall? This is one of the questions that comes to mind immediately. What is lost exactly and what remains? What's retained and what's lost, essentially? Has sin utterly obliterated the image of God or not? And it's certainly the case that the image of God is marred and twisted. We're no longer accurate representations of the Creator anymore. There's a host of different metaphors one could use, but I'll pick one. A beautiful portrait of somebody. It's obviously not the person themselves. It's a representation of them, but it's beautifully done. But if you deface it, if you scratch it up, if you cover it with a thick layer of grime, maybe you've misused it. Maybe you've used it as a tea tray or something, or a dustpan. In any case, the portrait still exists. It's still a picture of that particular real person, but it's no longer able to give the right impression of what that person looks like anymore. It can't show forth its true identity and purpose as a representation of that person anymore. It hasn't stopped being a portrait of that person, but it just does not reflect the reality. And so in a similar way, the image of God is hard to spot in ourselves and in others. Sometimes it's easier than other times. We catch glimpses of it in ourselves and in others, but it's not something that's easy to believe in just by looking around us, just looking at the evidence. If you're prone to cynicism, you can look around you at the state of the world and human history, and the last thing you would conclude was that we were somehow glorious. So, there's a fascinating passage in Genesis 5. And it goes like this. This is the written account of Adam's family line. When God created mankind, he made them in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And he named them mankind when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. Now, I had never noticed this passage until a couple weeks ago when I was listening to a lecture on the image of God. I'm like, whoa, that's a striking statement there, that Seth, the son of Adam, was in Adam's image. And it's deeply sad. It's a deeply sad statement, actually, because of the fall brought on by Adam and Eve's sin. Seth and everyone born after him will bear a distinct resemblance to Adam, who is now a broken and sinful man. And thankfully, the text does not say outright that people are no longer image bearers of God. It doesn't say that. But I think we can conclude that whatever the Imago Dei is, it will always be mixed up or intertwined with the Imago Adam, the image of Adam. We were made to resemble our Heavenly Father, but instead we resemble our forefather. And this is obviously bad news, but the Bible reassures us that actually our foundational identity has not changed. Remember, we talked about capacities and then the image of God as our foundational identity. That has not changed. It's still what a human being is. And in Genesis 9, you see, these are the three passages that mention the image of God, and they're the only three in the Old Testament. So we're covering all the bases tonight. This is Genesis 9, and this is when God renews the covenant with Noah after the flood. And from each human being, too, I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number. Multiply on the earth and increase upon it. So there's obvious echoes here of Genesis 1. The covenant with Noah takes the form of a renewal, actually, of Genesis 1, a renewal of the cultural blessing. God reaffirms that people are still his image in the world. But this time, God takes into account the grim reality that people will kill each other. So it is a explicitly post-fall scenario here. God isn't naive. He doesn't just reiterate what he said in Genesis 1. He's reiterating the truth of it, but in the context of a deeply broken situation now. In this context, the image of God is given as the reason why murder is wrong. But in any case, this shows that the fall has not removed the image of God from humanity. We are broken. We do things like commit murder. But we also are of great value because of the image. So it's an offense to God if someone kills us. So this is, God is affirming that the image is still there, but is not naive about the reality of human evil now. And there are many, many, many other ethical commands like this that don't mention the image of God directly as a form of justifying them, but they imply and assume it. So I'll just give two other ones from the Old and New Testament. Leviticus 19, this is something that I've, just one verse that I really love. It says, "Do not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block in front of the blind, but fear your God. I am the Lord." And so this is a picture of, you could curse the deaf and get away with it because they can't hear you. What are they going to do to you? You can put a stumbling block in front of a blind person. What are they going to do to you? They're blind. There's going to be no human payback for your cruelty. But God sees everything. And because the blind and the deaf, despite their limitations, are still in his image, you better not mistreat them. Fear God and treat them well is the implication there. In the book of James, another fascinating section, he's talking about the tongue, the way in which our tongues are unruly and do all kinds of damage. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and sea creatures are being tamed and have been tamed by mankind. But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse human beings who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this should not be. So again, And it's an ethical command about how we should treat people and not treat people based on the fact that the image of God is still what a human being is. And I'm not going to read it tonight, but go and read Psalm 8, because that's one of the Old Testament. It doesn't use the phrase image of God, but it includes, it's basically a reflection on the rule that God has given to human beings and the amazing thing that that is. We are so insignificant when we look at the stars, and yet we are elevated because God has made us in his image. So, the fall has obviously affected the image of God in different ways. I think because of my sin, I reject many of the responsibilities that are appropriate to the image. I corrupt them in some way. Many of the capacities I have, I've squandered and misused. There's a way in which, because we're sinners, we participate in the fallenness of the world around us. We perpetuate it. We continue smearing grime on the portrait, essentially, by how we live. But the image of God is also suppressed in us by forces that are out of our control. So we're not just participants in the fall, we're victims of a fallen world as well. And it's really important to keep those two things in mind as a meaningful distinction. The image of God is affected by both. It's affected by the things that I choose to do that are wrong, and it's affected by things that are out of my control. Illness, mental and physical disabilities, poverty, natural disasters, all these kinds of things radically limit our dominion, and they crush our capacity to express God's image fully, even though that's still our identity. So one of the images that we've used a lot of the Brie over the years, and I'm not sure exactly where it came from, is that of a glorious ruin. There's a cool website that has pictures of abandoned places on Earth. Has anyone ever seen this? There's tons and tons of really fascinating photographs of abandoned human dwellings or abandoned human spaces. And most of them are really beautiful, actually. But anyway, I was looking for images of glorious ruins back when I was doing this. So it's glorious, but it's marred and falling apart. So unable to function for its intended purpose, right? This is the sanctuary of a cathedral that's been overrun with ivy, and there appears to be a brook running through it. I'm not sure how that happened. But there's a couple of other ones just because they're so beautiful. I'll leave it on this one. So we can get a glimpse of the glory through the ivy and the rubble. The ruin, it really cannot fix itself. But there's hope that if we hold on to this idea of a glorious ruin, there's hope that a master builder can come along and see the potential for restoration in it and will someday restore it again. There's actually some glory to restore in each of us. Even though we look like an unsound structure. You can have a building that one person would say, oh, that should be condemned, right? That thing's falling down. Just tear it down. Don't bother trying to renovate it. And then someone else who knows what they're doing can come along and say, no, we could actually restore that beautifully. That's our hope. but I think it's a helpful metaphor because we tend to think of ourselves as either glorious glories or ruinous ruins. And neither are the case. We're some of both. Just a word about idolatry in this context as a post-fall reality. The degradation of idolatry. Idolatry is essentially, many people would sum up the whole problem with the story, the whole core of human sin, is idolatry. It's essentially to worship a God substitute, to make a new image of God. And remember that in the garden, human beings were like the statue of God that he placed in the temple of his creation. This means actually that to cheat and mistreat and lie to and exploit another human being is the equivalent of defacing and damaging the statue of the God in whose temple you're standing. So it's as if you're insulting that deity directly, and you'd better watch out. So this is something of the significance of what it is to mistreat other human beings. And this is why in the Old Testament the prophets so often rebuke the nation for idolatry on the one hand, and immediately rebuke the nation for injustice to the poor and the widow and the vulnerable. And the two go together hand in hand, because idol worship and social injustice follows from idol worship. They're connected. And so the prophets often rebuke and attack both together at the same time. When people abandon worship of the one true God, they invariably start to mistreat people who are his image. And usually the vulnerable people, the widows and the orphans, the refugees in the land, who have no means of recourse, who can't push you back when you push them. So it's one of the signs that we have abandoned worship of the living God when we mistreat the vulnerable, and who are equally his image bearers. When Jesus says, however you treat the least of these, you're doing that to me. And in a sense, he's reiterating that point. The image of God still stands in the fallen world, and that's why God gets angry when we exploit other people. And again, I said this earlier, but again, this is unbelievably radical. It may not sound radical to us now, but in the ancient Near East, just think of King David. King David would have been completely within his rights to rape Bathsheba and murder her husband to cover it up. Totally within his rights as a king in the ancient Near East. People would not have raised an eyebrow if it had been in Egypt or in Babylon. If David did not, despite his sin, if David did not believe in the image of God somewhere deep down, he would have refused to repent, and he probably would have had Nathan killed for confronting him and questioning his divine right to do whatever the heck he wanted in his kingdom. So the fact that David repents is an amazing thing. It shows that he doesn't actually think he has the right to do whatever he wants. And it shows that he actually, despite the horrible thing he's done, he still believes in the image of God. Because that's the only reason why, that's the only sort of moral ground that Nathan is standing on when he confronts David for rape and murder. So, if you read the book, my friend Andrew was reminding me earlier this week, the book of Micah, the prophet Micah, overwhelming emphasis on caring for the poor and the needy and what will happen to you if you don't. And everywhere that's implying the image of God. But of course, idolatry isn't just about mistreating other people. It's when we worship a false god, we denigrate ourselves as image bearers of the true God. So to worship an idol is to take something that is not just less significant than God, but is taking something that's less significant than us and calling it God and elevating it to divine status over ourselves and worshiping it. And that is the number one best way, according to the Bible, to become less human. We become less human when we take something that's actually not even as important as us and worship it. Something we've made, for instance. We actually degrade the image of God in ourselves. So we only really properly image God when we allow God to be God and show it by our obedience and our worship to him. And this is the book of Isaiah in various places talks about when you worship an idol, you become like the thing you're worshiping. So if you want to become mute and dumb and irresponsive, worship a god that's made out of wood, and that's what you will become. And the amazing thing is, or what's implied in much of this, is that if we actually strive to faithfully worship the living God, we will become more like him as well, which is to say we'll be imaging him as we should. So, moving on to redemption. In the New Testament, there are actually not many direct references to the image of God in people, but again, I think this is an assumed belief that the original readers would have had. The New Testament emphasizes much more the fact that Christ is the perfect image of God who has come to restore the image back to humanity. And this begins with the identity of Jesus and the incarnation itself. So Anthony Heikema, again, I might not have done this. Never mind. I'll just read the quote. I don't have it. he connects the image of God with the incarnation. And he says that God could become flesh is the greatest of all mysteries, which will always transcend our finite human understanding. But presumably, it was only because man had been created in the image of God that the second person of the Trinity could become a human, could assume human nature. That second person, it would seem, could not have assumed a nature that had no resemblance whatever to God. He's talking about how, why didn't Jesus come, why didn't the second person of the Trinity come as an animal or something? He's like, no, that actually it would never have happened that way. In other words, the incarnation confirms the doctrine of the image of God. It's because human beings were already made in God's image that it's a miraculous mystery, but yet somehow appropriate that God could still become a human being. Jesus was God himself, but fully God and fully human. And the book of Hebrews refers to Jesus as the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. So Jesus is proclaimed in the New Testament as being in essence one with the Creator, something that we could never claim of ourselves, even though we were made in his image. But then Jesus is also, because he was a man, he's described in the scriptures as being the perfect image of God. So in Colossians 1, this is this amazing, it's talking about the supremacy of Christ in all things, and it begins with this statement: he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. And then it goes on to talk about everything else that Jesus is. But he is the image of the invisible God for us, who's come to us. And Jesus remained faithful in all the ways that Adam failed. So this is what Paul means when he talks about the new Adam, is Jesus Christ. And he has succeeded in the ways that the first Adam had failed and brought death. In 1 Corinthians 15, I apologize for not having this on the screen. I didn't have time at the last minute to finish my PowerPoint presentation. So you get to look at this pile of rubble here. But Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, starting in verse 48, as was the earthly man, so are those who are of the earth. And he's talking about the resurrection of the body. He's talking about the resurrection of our bodies on the last day, and contrasting Adam with Jesus. As was the earthly man, so are those who are of the earth. And as is the heavenly man, so also are those who are of heaven. And just as we have borne the image of the earthly man, so shall we bear the image of the heavenly man. So Paul is saying that before the coming of the heavenly man, we all, like Seth, were in the image of Adam, which is that passage I read a minute ago in Genesis 5. Sin corrupted the image of God, and we resembled our forefather instead. But because of the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, we become new creations who are remade in the image, this time of Christ, who is God himself. And so, obviously, the Bible teaches very clearly that in order for this image to be restored, our sin has to be dealt with. And what separates us from a relationship with God has to be taken away. So Jesus Christ takes on the guilt of our sin in his death on the cross, credits us with his righteousness, so that even though we still sin every day, God looks upon us and sees the righteousness of his Son. And one day, and this is what Paul is getting at in 1 Corinthians 15, we will be made fully like Christ so that, like him, we will be perfectly reflecting the image of God again. So it's a restoration project of the image of God to us again, but through Jesus Christ, who is the perfect image of God. It's only through our connection to Jesus that we can recover the fullness of God's image. And in the meantime, all of the language about sanctification, it says our striving to be godly, our striving to become more like Christ, it's all about trying to image God. As we imitate Christ, we are imaging God, or striving to image God. And it's a work of the Holy Spirit in us, gradually transforming us to be more like Christ. And there's various passages that deal with that. One of them is in 2 Corinthians 3. The other is in Romans 8. And I'll just read the Romans 8, starting in verse 28. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. And so, Christians today who are wondering what the image of God means, it is a preoccupation to think about all the ways in which we are more like God than the animals. The real significant thing is to look at the person of Christ for what the image of God is, because that's God showing us what a human being imaging God perfectly is. And so it's in imitating him that we are, in all the ways that he displays his goodness in the New Testament. We think of his commitment to speaking the truth, his unwavering obedience to his Father in heaven, his anger at sin and the effects of the fall, his compassion and love for broken people, his willingness to suffer unjustly. All these things are aspects of who Christ is that we are supposed to imitate. And as we do so, we will be imaging our Father in heaven. and we'll fail, of course. And so the great hope is that one day we will be made like him fully and finally reflect our Maker as we should. And I know it's getting on, but I want to just end with a couple of reflections that we will continue to discuss tomorrow. Implications today for the image of God. I mean, that one of the obvious ones that we've already been talking about is that I really think the image of God has never ceased to be relevant to the needy and the poor and the people who are disenfranchised. It's always a relevant word because it means that all the ways in which society tends to value people or place values and significance on people need to be dismantled, because wealth and power and popularity and high opinion polls actually get you nothing with God, get you nowhere with God. We are viewed as equally valuable by him, unworthy but of great worth. Secondly, I think we need to be creative. Christians need to be creative about finding ways to reveal the folly of idolatry. The Bible is full of all kinds of rich language, including some satire and just to point out the folly that it is to worship something you've made rather than to worship the one who made you. And like I said earlier, it's one of the most devastating ways to degrade the image of God in ourselves, to worship something that actually has less dignity than ourselves. And one of the ways in which we can do this, I think, is to sort of fan into flames people's sense of a need for meaning, a need that for something that an idol can't provide to them. Because idols don't make us, we make them. And no idol can give us a sense of significance and meaning and purpose that everybody, whether they admit it or not, is actually longing for on some level or another. Some idea of being, of having meaning. And then the last thing I just want to throw out there, and maybe this can be sort of a springboard for discussion or whatever anyone wants to talk about is fine, but one of the assumptions in American culture today is that we all construct our own identities. Identity is something that you decide. You decide who you are. You decide who you want to be, and you do your best to become that. And nobody can tell you who you are. Nobody can tell you or try to define your identity. It's up to you to construct it yourself. And at the same time, we're living in one of the most polarized times in U.S. history. Probably, I mean, who knows? I'm not very old, but the history books say the Civil War was pretty polarized. So I don't want to. But certainly, we are living in an increasingly polarized society, polarized over all kinds of different issues. People are becoming less and less capable of speaking to each other because of differences in political views, differences on sexual ethics, differences to do with race and ethnic identity. There's fewer and fewer real conversations happening across those boundaries. And people are just sort of retreating and having conversations with people that are exactly like them and getting angry about the people over there. And that this has increased in the past couple months, I would say. But it's been happening for a long time. One of the things that makes people so entrenched and incapable of civil communication is that when we are constructing our identities, think of it, if we're all constructing our own identities and we're trying to force one aspect of who we are to become the whole thing, which is another way of saying, I'm trying to make one aspect of myself go all the way down, like Mary Stuart Van Leeuwen said. The image of God is the only thing that goes all the way down, but I'm trying to make something else go all the way down. My politics define me. My love or my hatred for Donald Trump defines me. Either way, you know. My sexual identity defines me. That is my identity all the way down. When we do this, there's no possible way for someone to critique or even question my views without implicitly judging my whole person, right? Because I have actually reduced my whole person to that one thing. And as Christians, I think we need to really grow in our ability to communicate and show that the image of God is real, that we really believe this. And I think that living out the image of God is the only way to differ with someone while treating them with love and respect and dignity. The trick is to convince them that that's what we really believe, you know, which maybe to have more people over to our houses and feed them more often, rather than just say, you know, the cliche, which is, you know, I love the sinner but hate the sin. That does not really hold ring true for people today. We need to do it in more costly and intentional ways. But if my neighbor defines their whole identity by some aspect of themselves, say their politics, it's my responsibility as a Christian to show that I believe their identity is bigger than that. I believe that they are more significant than they even think they are. And that's, I can only do that if I believe in the image of God. And my hope and prayer is that as we reflect on the image of God as being really our true identity and something that we share with people, even people who radically disagree with us, somehow we can find ways of communicating that reality that will help us to actually speak civilly and start conversations which have been getting more and more rare. The real difference is that I don't believe I can construct my identity. I believe my identity was given to me. So the whole theme weekend is entitled, Who Does God Say We Are? That's the question. It's the fact that God says we're his image, not the fact that I have constructed something for myself. That's where I'm going to end. And we always, whether or not we leave time for it, we always encourage discussion. And so anybody that wants to ask questions or make comments, it's free to. And if it's time for you to go, that's fine too. But we'll just kick it off. Any questions?